Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining our virtual community and supporting our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
So start with the unbegotten God. What does it even mean, unbegotten God? What does it mean that God isn't begotten? Well, here's what it means. And this is my analogy. I want you to think of, try to picture, visualize in your mind a leaf kind of swirling and blowing down the street. What caused that leaf to swirl and blow down the street? Huh? That it moves like that. Wind, right? Wind. Okay, so the wind is pushing the leaf down the street. But what caused that wind in the first place? Well, I'll tell you what it was. It was air molecules smashing into each other in a chaotic manner, and they created this turbulence that made the wind. But what caused those air molecules to get so excited that they started smashing into each other? I'll tell you what I think that was. That was the sunlight heating the atmosphere unevenly as it strikes the atmosphere of the Earth, right? So then the question is, well, but where'd that sunlight come from? And that's really cool, because that sunlight comes from fusion reactions on the sun, where there's these huge hydrogen explosions happening all the time. But what caused those fusion reactions, those hydrogen explosions? And so you see what I'm doing? You can just keep going back. You can take any observable thing in the entire universe and trace it back, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, all the way back to what? To the very first cause, the very first beginning of everything, which might be the Big Bang, or it might be whatever caused the Big Bang. But my point is that everything in the observable universe is an effect of a cause. Something caused it. And there's a chain of events, cause and effect, that got us to here all the way now, right? That's the idea. That's the idea. That's the universe. What I just described is the whole universe. And you can figure it out by watching a leaf swirl around. But this implies that there was at some point a first cause. A first cause is something uncaused. So what caused the first cause? Nothing caused the first cause. That means the first cause must be God. Okay, so this is how we come to the idea of the unbegotten God, that nothing made God in the first place. God is the beginning of everything. Okay, so somebody who believes in God is called a theist. You know the first commandment? You know what the first commandment of the Ten Commandments is? Not the greatest commandment like we talked about last week, but the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. What's the first commandment of the Ten Commandments? I am the Lord your God. So, in other words, believe in God. So, we are theists. All right? But there's different kinds of theists. Oh, you know what theology is? Theology? Study of God, actually. Theos is God in Greek. So theology is the study of God. So a theist is somebody who believes in God. But there's different kinds of theists. There's atheists. What would that be? Someone who doesn't believe in God, right? So the atheist doesn't believe in God. And then there's the agnostic. That's not a theist at all. You know what? A theist believes God exists. An agnostic believes that God doesn't exist, or no, an atheist believes God doesn't exist, and an agnostic says, I don't know. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. It's not up to me. How would I know, right? So agnostics are pretty honest people. They're kind of like the most honest of anyone, because they're like, well, I really couldn't prove if he does or he doesn't exist. I don't know if he exists or not. But they're also lazy. They don't want to take a position. And really, most agnostics haven't actually thought about it. They're just it's just an easy out. It's just like, I don't have to commit to anything, keep my options open, right? So those are the different categories. Obviously, we're not agnostics and we're not atheists. We are theists. And we're not just any kind of theist. The Shema tells us, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That makes us monotheists. Mono means one. Unlike poly. Poly, not like Polly Sundstrom, but polytheist. A polytheist is somebody who believes in many gods. So today, most people believe in monotheism. That's the belief in one God, right? But it's not always been the case. Back in the days of the Bible, the Jewish people were pretty much the only people in the world that believed in only one God, because everybody else believed that there was many gods. I mean, it seemed obvious. You think about it. You have night and day. There must be two gods, a god of the night, god of the day. You have the sun and the moon. That implies a god of the sun, god of the moon. You've got land and sea, god of the sea, god of the land. You've got life and death. You've got all these opposites. It seems like there's, you know, so there's spring, there's rain, there's, you know, all these different things that are happening. What's going on here must be all these different gods exerting their influence at different times. Today, we know better, because today we have science, the scientific method. The scientific method says, look, all of these things are part of the same system. They're all subject to the same rules of physics. The same laws of physics are working to create every one of these effects that you see. There's no disjuncture here. Instead, everything is proceeding textbook according to these laws of cause and effect. And so modern science validates monotheism, if it's going to validate a theism at all. If modern science believes in God at all, and many scientists do, it's going to be monotheism, not polytheism. Does that make sense? But back in the day, back in the days of the Bible, Abraham and Moses being monotheists, I mean, they're like upsetting the apple cart. This is very disruptive ideas, because everybody thought they were crazy. It's like, obviously there's many gods. Not the case nowadays. But you got to understand, when you're looking at the first chapter of Genesis and it's telling you on the first day, on the second day, and, you know, and God created this and God created that, this is a story that's come to tell us that there's only one God. It's teaching us that there isn't a different God for each of these different things that were created on these different days. That's the point of Genesis chapter 1. Okay. If God is, and if you have any questions, just feel free to like interrupt me and stop me, because I'm just going to keep teaching really fast. If God is the first cause, that necessarily puts him into a category, a different category than everything else in the universe. This is an amazing idea. This is the idea, we call this idea transcendence. Transcendence, that God is transcendent. I want you to think of it this way. I mean, we're all familiar with three dimensions, length, height, width, right? You know, those are the three dimensions that define space. And then if you could throw time in there for a sequence of actions and events and motion, you know, so maybe they'll get four dimensions out of it. Whatever. The point is that God can't be measured by any of these three dimensions or four dimensions. Time doesn't apply to him. Length doesn't apply to him. He's not so high or so wide or anything like that, because he's completely outside of the universe. He's not part of this universe. He transcends the universe. And that stands to reason, because he's the first cause and everything else. Therefore, everything else in a chain of cause and effect is, first of all, an effect. Before it was a cause, it was an effect. Everything is caused, except for the first cause. Nothing caused God, and that puts him outside of a world of cause and effect. I'm going to explain this to you. Well, here, Solomon says, look, I made a house for you to live in, God. But you, even the heavens can't contain you. The universe can't contain you. How much less this house? So Solomon is teaching us this idea of transcendence. Oh yeah, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then God's spirit was moving over the water. So the very first thing he does is creates the heavens and the earth. In other words, the universe. The very first thing he does. So then the earth is formless and void. It says the earth is formless and void. The first act of creation results in, anyway, that's another conversation. We can maybe someday study Bereshit, because that's got a lot of interesting mysteries in it. I'm going to give you an analogy to help you explain, to help you understand this difficult concept of transcendence. All right? Transcendence. Here's the analogy. This is the one I always use. Imagine a painter. The painter is going to paint a picture. In the picture, he paints a happy little farm scene. There's a farmhouse, there's a barn, a farmyard, some farm animals, a farmer, the farmer's wife, the farmer's children, a dog and a cat. All in the same picture, all right? Now let's think about the relationship between these people in the painting and the painter. The people in the painting can't see the painter because the painter's outside of the painting. Everything in the painting is caused, but he's the causer. So that means that he's not part of the painting. You think, well, obviously he's not part of the painting, he's the painter, right? No, he's outside the painter. So if the people in the painting are saying, do you believe in a painter? Do you think there's really a painter? And they look around. So one of them looks around and says, obviously, look, I see a house, I see a barn, I see some cows, I see, yeah, but I don't see a painter. Where's this painter that everybody believes in? You know, this is the atheist, right? He doesn't, right? And then the agnostic's like, well, I don't know, there could be a painter. How would I know, right? You know, so you're starting to see the issue here. But the painter himself can't be part of, by definition, he can't be in the picture. And the people in the picture can't see the painter. So here's what happens when the atheist comes to you and says, well, I don't believe in God. I don't see God. Who sees God? Nobody sees God. You can't prove there's a God. You say, exactly. If you could see him, or if you could prove him, or if you could quantify him, that would make him part of this universe. And then he wouldn't be God anymore, would he? Then he wouldn't be transcendent anymore, would he? Because he'd be in this universe. So what the model predicts, the model of a transcendent God, is a God that you absolutely can't see or really know or experience in any way, that you really wouldn't have any knowledge of. So we call this the world of concealment, because within the universe, when you're in the painting, you can't see what's outside the painting. You can only see what's in the painting. When you're in the universe, you can only see what's in the universe. You can't see what's outside of the universe. What's outside of the universe is God. It's Hashem. This is the idea. This is the problem with atheism. Atheism is for very small minds. Agnosticism, like I said, is more honest, but atheism makes this huge leap of faith to say, oh, only what I can see and observe is what's real. As if that was the case, as if only what we can see and observe is what's real. Scientists tell us that most of the universe is unobservable. It's something called dark matter. Dark matter, it can't be seen, can't be smelled, can't be touched, can't be tasted. In fact, we haven't even discovered it yet. It's true, we haven't even discovered it yet because it's invisible and whatnot. But we know it's there because mathematically it has to be there for the universe to work. We just don't know what it is, all right? But just because we can't see it or we haven't found it yet doesn't mean it doesn't exist. All right, so if that's the case for something within the universe, how much more so for Hashem, who is outside of the universe? Anyway, that's the idea of transcendence. God is like a painter outside of the painting. And guys like Spinoza, you ever heard of Spinoza? He's a philosopher, Jewish philosopher. Not on the Derek, you might say. He wasn't like a Torah guy. But Spinoza is a philosopher, or Einstein. You ever heard of Einstein? He's a scientist. These two, they come up with the idea. They say, look, and many, many other philosophers as well say, look, I believe in God. I'm a theist. And I'm even a monotheist because I'm a scientist. All right? But I don't believe in the God of the Bible. Instead, I believe that God created the universe, because obviously there's a universe here, so obviously there has to be a first cause. I mean, this isn't rocket science. God created the universe, but then he went off and created other universes. You know, and he left this one to be its. So it's like the painter painted the painting of the farm, and he said, okay, that's nice, and he set it over there, and then he went off, and he started painting another painting of some other thing, right? And that's it. And so what that means is that he has no further interaction with the painting, and the people inside the painting really will never have any real clear, they certainly won't have a relationship with the painter or really know for sure that a painter exists or anything like that. It's just like, well, that's that. All right, that's not us. Disciples of Yeshua believe in a personal God. He's sentient. He's a personality. It means that he's aware. And not only that, but according to the revelation of the Bible, and this is sort of a leap that we're accepting this, but we believe that this God is trying to communicate with us and trying to reveal himself to us. And that's called revelation. When you get something from outside of the painting, that's called revelation. And And not only that, but he wants a relationship with us, with his creatures. So go back to the painting. Think of the painting again. And imagine that the painter says, you know, I just really like these people that I painted in this farm scene. I sure wish that they could meet me and know me and know something about me. What's he going to do? He can't get in the painting. He can shout it, hey, people, I'm here. They're not going to hear him. They're a painting, right? They're not going to hear him. There's no way for him to communicate with them or them to communicate with him. But then the painter has an idea. He says, wait a second. I'm a painter. What if I was to paint me in the picture? And so this is what he does. He paints himself, a little self, not his whole self, not his three-dimensional self or his whole person, but it's a pretty accurate, he's a really good painter, it's a pretty accurate depiction of himself in the painting. And now all of a sudden the people in the painting can see him. Well, it's not really him, but they get the idea. It's like, whoa, okay, this is the idea of revelation, that God is able to reveal himself in this world. But it's not really God in his fullness. It's like a finite version of God, because the infinite doesn't ever fit in the finite. Infinite's bigger than finite. Infinite can't fit in finite. So the infinite doesn't fit in the finite. The infinite God doesn't fit in the finite universe, right? So he has to create, so to speak, a finite version of himself. It's not a different God. It's not like a different Hashem. As if now we're polytheists. It's not a different God. Instead, it's connected to him. It's an expression of his being. Just like you're hearing my voice right now. You're hearing me speak. But, I mean, what you're hearing is actually not me. It's sound waves wobbling through the air, right? But it's me speaking. It's like that. And, in fact, it's called the Word. That's what, in Judaism, that's what we call this version of God who can enter the finite world and that we see and experience. It's called the Word. In Hebrew, it's called the Bera. In Aramaic, it's called Memra. In Greek, it's called Logos. The Word. All right, so what is the Word? Well, the Word is, for example, when you hear this word, let there be light. That's the Word speaking. When he says to Noah, build an ark. When he says to Abraham, leave the land of your fathers. When he says, this is all the Word. When the angel of the Lord appears, that's the Word. That's the Memra. That's the Word of God. Because it's the painter painting. In fact, all things are made through the Word. It says in the Gospel of John, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It was in the beginning with God, and all things came into being through it, and apart from it, nothing came into being that has come into being. So you could even think, so God created the whole universe through the Word. You could even think of, like, in our painter analogy, that the Word is almost like the tip of that paintbrush. Where the tip of that paintbrush touches the canvas, that's like the Word at work. So the Word is what speaks from Mount Sinai in the burning bush, or says, I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, right? So forth. This is called Memra. And this is how we know about God. It's also called revelation. This is God's revelation to humanity. God's transcendence, we're all clear on the term transcendence now, all right? So God's transcendence also explains three otherwise impossible things about God that we should know. What are they? His omniscience. That means God knows everything. He even knows what you thought. He knows what you're thinking right now. He knows what you're going to think when you're done thinking that. He knows what you're going to think tomorrow. He knows what you thought yesterday. He knows everything, every molecule. God knows everything, which is just impossible. How could anyone know everything? That's called omniscience. There's God's omnipresence. He's omnipresent. That means God is everywhere. There's no place God isn't. God can be more than one place at one time. All right. And then there's God's omnipotence. That means God's all powerful. All right. Now, none of these things make any sense. All three of them are actually completely impossible within the universe. But if you were outside of the universe, if you were the one who created the universe, all of them make total sense. Because if you created the whole painting, you're not going to, you can take in the whole thing at one glance. You can see the whole painting and you recognize every brush stroke. So your omniscience is no big deal if you're first cause outside of the chain of cause and effect. And omnipresence, also no big deal because you're not one spot in the painting. You're not like stuck over there in the barn in the painting or something like that. You're outside of that. You know, those laws of can only be in one place at one time, only stuck here, that none of that applies to you. That's three-dimensional thinking. And same goes for omnipotence. If you created the whole painting, you can change the painting at will. You can erase that guy. You can like say, you know, rather than the barn, I'd like to, you can do whatever you want. You could start over. You can paint anything you want. So that's all, you know, that all makes sense. So these three things about that we know about God, omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence, only make sense from the point of view of transcendence. All right? We've made our big assumption. What's our big assumption? Our big assumption, then, is that as theists, that God actually wants to communicate with us. That he is painting himself into the painting. That he wants a relationship with us. Now, maybe Einstein's right, and maybe Spinoza is right. And if they're right, then the Bible is wrong, and we're wrong. But if we're right, then our task becomes very simple. Our quest for truth becomes very simple. If we're right, all that we need to do is to find some historical record. We need to look through history. We need to look through the record of humanity. And we need to find some sort of historical record which validates this experience of revelation. Is there? Just run through your mind through all of world history and world religions and philosophies, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and think to yourself, is there any consistent record of a first cause, a deity, an omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient deity revealing himself to humanity in a consistent manner over time? And you will find the Jews. They have it going on. Judaism. This is the only religion in the world that fits the model that we're talking about. And once you arrive at that, then you realize the Bible. The Bible is this compendium of these revelations that have taken place over this sweep of history. So, disciples of Yeshua, we're all about the kingdom, right? We're all about seeking the kingdom first. It's our top priority, as we already learned. So what is the kingdom, and how does the kingdom fit into this? Well, this is very simple. This is the simplest, easiest part of the lesson, and this is the takeaway. Even if you everything else just kind of like goes over your head, that's fine. Here's the takeaway. When we realize that God is the first cause, that he is the only God, and that he wants to reveal himself in a relationship with his creation, which is us, his creatures, then all of a sudden you realize that nothing else makes any difference. Everything else in life, everything else in the universe is inconsequential and irrelevant to this one big, big, big meaning of life, and that is to know God and to have relationship with the Creator. And that's why disciples seek the kingdom first. Because disciples believe, we believe this on the basis of Yeshua's teaching and the basis of the Bible, that there's going to be a time in the future when God will be revealed in a powerful way and everybody's going to know him. It's as if everything and everyone in the whole world is suddenly going to realize, oh, there's a painter. We're in a painting and there's a painter. And in that day, the prophets say that everyone is going to know the Lord from the least to the greatest. And it says the knowledge of the Lord will cover the earth like the waters cover the sea. We call that future era. We call that the kingdom of heaven, the Malkut Shemayim. And in the kingdom, here's the deal. When we get to the kingdom, there's no atheists left because everyone knows the Lord. There's no agnostics because, you know, agnostics say, well, you can't know. And now you do know. So there's no agnostics left in the kingdom. There's only theists and it's only monotheists. And everyone realizes there's only one God. And he's the only thing that matters. And that's what we mean when we end every service with the words, Bayom HaHu, right? And in that day, the Lord will be king over the whole earth, and his name will be one. The Lord will be one, and his name will be one. That's what we end every synagogue service with, those words, to remember. What's the point of all this? What's the goal here? What are we doing here on earth? I mean, not just in the synagogue, which is another question. What are we doing on earth? Well, this is what we're doing, that the Lord will be one and his name will be one.